The Athletic.
The first trophy of the season in England goes to...
Arsenal! Beat Chelsea again for the second consecutive year to win the Continental Cup!
Stina Blackstenius' extra time goal won it 1-0.
It's Blackstenius!
That was for her best mate, Frieda Leonardson-Mornum, who sadly collapsed during the match. Thankfully, she's stable now. And to cap that all off, as the managers went to shake hands, Emma Hayes pushed Jonas Eideval. So what's the beef between the Chelsea and Arsenal managers? And how did the Gunners win the League Cup? I'm Sophie Penny, and from The Athletic, this is Full Time Europe. Later, we'll be chatting about the news that ex-England captain Steph Houghton is retiring.
I think, really, Houghton should be predominantly remembered for being an incredible free kick taker.
But first, they were both at Molineux to see Arsenal lift the League Cup. It's our full-time columnist Jessie Barker-Humphreys and The Athletic's Arsenal reporter Art de Roche. Hi to you both.
Good afternoon.
Hiya.
You've already been on our podcast, The Daily Football Briefing, Straight Out of Cobham and Handbrake Off, talking about this in brief. But now we've got time to go into it in depth. I would encourage everyone to go and check out those three podcasts, by the way. Jessie, goodness me, so much drama.
Yeah, it had a dramatic finish, but I don't know how dramatic it was during the game itself. Art and I were sat next to each other for this one, and I feel like we had a couple of moments where we were like grabbing each other because it felt like something was going to happen, but not much actually did until the very end.
Art, I mean, sitting next to Jessie, obviously a Chelsea fan, you're an Arsenal fan. What does it mean to Arsenal? Sorry to rub it in, Jessie. What does it mean to Arsenal to win this League Cup?
I think a lot about this League Cup was quite similar to last year, in the fact that it was Arsenal's only realistic route to silverware. But more so than just a trophy, I think it's important to show there is some tangible quality within that squad that's able to compete with Chelsea and, of course, Manchester City as well. So yeah, for the short term, it's good to have something there. But in the long term, I think it needs to be used as something to push on from.
That's now Arsenal's seventh League Cup win. And for Chelsea, of course, it means that the quadruple is no longer possible in Emma Hayes' last season. They've now lost the League Cup final 3 years in a row. And speaking of Emma Hayes, we have to talk about what happened between her and Jonas Eideval in this match. You saw the scenes on the final whistle. Eideval goes to shake Emma Hayes' hand. They sort of hold each other's hands, but then Emma Hayes pushes Eideval away and says something to him. It seems like this was in response to an incident that happened with Aaron Cuthbert on the touchline. Jonas Eideval later explained that in that incident, he was shouting because they had a one-ball system in this match, and Chelsea apparently tried to use a multi-ball system in that moment when it suited them towards the end of the game. And he said that that was the source of his frustration. Before I get Jessie and Art's reaction, I'll play you now what Emma Hayes had to say about it all after the game, and then what Jonas Eideval had to say.
Listen, I think there's a way to conduct yourself on the touchline. I really do. And I think that it's absolutely essential we role model in the right way. But I'm not down for male aggression on the touchline. I'm not. And fronting up with players, for me, that's unacceptable. And yeah, I was disappointed, and I told Jonas that. I don't think it's okay to behave like that. He got a yellow card, and in fact, he probably should have been sent off. I'm all for competing to win. I've never been booked in 12 years, you know, my time here. I totally accept he's a winner and he wants to win, but his behaviour on the touchline wasn't acceptable.
I don't see it as a big thing. I definitely don't see me as aggressive in that situation. I think that's very irresponsible, putting that label onto it. I think there is definitely a way that you behave in the technical area to it. I also think there is a way you behave after the game, being a good winner, but you also need to be a good loser. And you need to be responsible in both those situations to it. And I'm actually happy with the way I conduct myself. And then others need to look at themselves in the mirror and see if they're happy with themselves.
Jesse, I'll come to you first. What did you make of that incident? I know you've written a lot on The Athletic. There's a great piece on there about the rivalry between Jonas Eidevall and Emma Hayes. What did you make of that incident?
Yeah, I thought it was a great way to finish off. Some people
with
said,
a bang.
Yeah, after that piece that, you know, the rivalry wasn't really there because I guess Hayes has won more than Eidevall has in his time in the league. But I think that just showed there's certainly no love lost between the two of them. And I think it was interesting from Hayes. I feel like as much as it felt like her temper boiled over, I also think she's a very clever person. And I wonder if there was something a little bit calculated about it as well. I think she's a pro at deflecting from things when she wants to deflect. And I part of me thinks this was the perfect way that we're all sat here talking about Hayes versus Eidevall rather than the fact that, you know, her team lost a third consecutive Conti Cup final and what her role might have been in that.
That's a really interesting take on it. And we will get into the football later. We promise we'll give it a good chunk of time so Hayes doesn't win in that manner, if that's what she was trying to do. I want to talk to you about her use of words when she was describing the incident. She said male aggression. Some people in the comments on your piece on The Athletic about this have kind of questioned why she used the word male. Just wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think what probably didn't help Eidevall in the whole situation was he has previous for being very animated on the touchline and with Eidevall also, more so than other managers. I'd say when you see him in a freeze frame in those moments, he can look very angry. And with this going back over, say, the past three seasons where he's had run-ins with Gareth Taylor, also Mark Skinner, I believe, where they've mentioned his behavior on the touchline, it then probably becomes an easier label to tag him with. But yeah, after watching the video back, it's very clear to me anyway that he's actually talking to the officials about the ball. He's not even facing Aaron Cuthbert at first. And then obviously they come together in that moment. But yeah, I guess the reason why it's a bit easier for Hayes to use that language is because Eidevall is already very kind of animated on the touchline and has previous for other managers using similar language against him.
Yeah, I think Hayes's problem is that because she then pushed him, it feels hard to say, you know, this is some kind of male masculine aggression that we don't want to see in the women's game because she then pushed him on television, which I feel like is, you know, kind of worse than anything Eidevall did. I do think he's a very aggressive personality on the sidelines. And I think actually, if you take a step back from men's or women's football, that personality I personally find quite unpleasant. Like you see Jurgen Klopp like yelling in the faces of fourth officials all the time. I don't think it should really be acceptable. And I think Emma Hayes's broader points about what does it mean to be, you know, a role model? What does it mean to be somebody who stands on the sidelines when we're talking about like abuse referees get? I don't think it's a great look, whether he's yelling at Cuthbert or the fourth official, because he was going at the fourth official for the whole match. It was right in front of us. So, and this wasn't like a one-off incident at all. And I do think that's a problem. And I think that is something that should be discussed around whether that is acceptable behavior. I don't necessarily think it has to be about a gender thing. But at the same time, I think it's naive to think that people aren't going to look at images of a very tall man yelling at, you know, even if it's because Aaron Cuthbert's come up to him. And trust me, I mean, I would potentially back Cuthbert in a fight against Eidevall if it came down to that. I don't think she's someone you want to mess with at all. But obviously the freeze frame. So when you're looking at like a shorter woman going up against a tall guy, of course they look bad. And as Art said, I think the previous incidents don't do Eidevall any favours. You know, he might not have gone up to Cuthbert in this situation, but when he had a go at Martha Thomas over a challenge in a game against United, I think it was a Conti Cup game against United back in his first season, he like basically almost comes onto the pitch to have a go at her then. And I think That's the kind of issue here. As much as I don't think Hayes conducted herself particularly well, and as much as maybe the incident itself has been overblown, there's enough other aspects of his behaviour, I think, for us to say maybe the way you're behaving generally isn't actually acceptable.
What's interesting as well here is this kind of marks the end of an era, doesn't it, for Jonas Eideval and Emma Hayes. It was their last meeting, wasn't it? And Jesse, you write about this, that this didn't just start here. As you say, there've been other incidents with Jonas on the touchline, but also the rivalry between them, which really kind of fires him up. It started as soon as he arrived at Arsenal, didn't it, Jesse?
Yeah, obviously there's, you know, his first win in the league was against Chelsea at the Emirates. And at the end, he kind of like famously and dramatically sunk to his knees in a way that I think, you know, we've come to see even when we're talking about Eideval in the context of maybe being aggressive or going too far on the touchline. I think it's all, you know, part of him being a very big personality. And that's why him and Hayes' rivalry has been so fascinating, because Hayes is a massive personality. And I personally feel like Eideval's the first person really who's come into this league and been like, no, I want to be top dog here. And I'm going to talk about what I think and behave how I want to behave. You know, he since said about that, like, celebration and the over-celebration that, you know, he'd had a tough time moving over. And I mean, you can take or leave that. Ultimately, you just beat the league winners at home in your first game of the season. I think it's okay to have, you know, celebrated regardless. But obviously, Chelsea found that irritating enough that when they won the league, they mocked his celebration in their photos lifting the trophy. And yeah, since then, we've had black cats. We had last year when they won the Conti Cup, Emma Hayes going, oh, they look like a team who hadn't won much. She made a similar jibe in her post-match saying that this was what Arsenal like, this is all they had to play for, which is true. But again, I think, you know, there's definitely this feeling of, you know, antagonism between the two of them. What I thought was really interesting was, sort of before the Stamford Bridge game, we had a lot of more like kind of respectful, oh, you know, we've had good conversations off the pitch. We really like learn from each other, blah, 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 blah. And before the Conti Cup final, it was, oh, well, we don't bump into each other outside of football matches. You know, we only sort of see each other there. And you're thinking, well, last week you were telling us about the great chats you have outside of the game. So someone's not saying something true. but yeah, I think it's going to be a rivalry that the WSL will miss.
I liked how he said, Jonas Eideval said that the only manager he has a beer with after the game is Matt Beard from Liverpool. That really made me chuckle. Well, we'll see. I mean, what happens when Emma Hayes leaves Chelsea for the US women's national team? Another major moment of this match was obviously Frida Leonhardsen-Morlum collapsing on the pitch. Thankfully, Arsenal let us know quite quickly that she was conscious, talking in a stable condition. We understand that she didn't need to go to hospital and she did travel back with the team. For people watching on TV, they won't have seen that happen because it was out of shot, because the ball was the other end of the pitch. Did either of you see that happen?
I saw her like start to fall.
No one around her?
No. But I think Katie McCabe also saw it in motion. So she was the first player to really kind of call over the physio. She was trying to get them on before the refs even waved them on. And then after that, it was just, yeah, silence, as you'd expect from most of the stadium. For some reason, there were some pockets that chose to kind of stick to that tribalism of a normal football match in a situation that didn't really need it. But during that period, it was just about making sure the medical team had the space and I guess the quiet as well to do their jobs and make sure Frida was okay, which thankfully she was by the time she had to come off the pitch.
And what did the players and Jonas Eideval say after the game about kind of how they were feeling in that moment and how it affected them afterwards?
Jonas spoke about how in the game at Stamford Bridge, Arsenal did not deal with high pressure, high emotion well. Whereas this time around, they basically stayed task orientated. So controlling what they could control in terms of football, which I think took probably a few minutes for them to get back into. Chelsea as well, because it was such a jarring moment in the game. It didn't seem like a normal, say, extra time, for instance. It did take a while for the players to really look normal again. But from an Arsenal perspective, Lotta Wubemoy also spoke about how once they kind of hit that adversity, they also feel like a team that can thrive within that. So I guess last season was a big example of that with all the injuries they had and how they responded to those to win the Conti Cup and get to the Champions League semi-final. And this was maybe an unfortunate but latest example of that. Stina Blackstenius, obviously, as you mentioned, Sophie's her best friend, and said that she was able to send her a text like straight after the game, but she hadn't seen her by the time she'd come to speak to the media in the mix zone. But yeah, as you said earlier, she managed to travel back on the night and didn't have to go to the hospital. So positive signs so far.
And they ended up winning it for her. So that's great to see it as well. Right. I promised it that we'd get into the football. So let's do some match analysis next.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to michelobultra.com/courtside to learn more.
You're listening to Full Time Europe from The Athletic.
Both sides had chances in this game. It was Stina Blackstenius' goal in the 116th minute that won it. Jesse, it was a very even game, wasn't it? But you mentioned to me before we started recording that you thought that perhaps it might have been won and lost in the subs.
Yeah, I think obviously there were tactical things that I think worked well for both sides. To be honest, I thought neither team was really at their best. I think you could tell that both sides had the experience of being absolutely whooped by the other one. That's the technical term earlier in the season. And I think both looked quite nervous at points. But as the game went on, I think it sort of opened up and it became more transitional. Eidevall was pretty proactive with subs. Obviously, two were enforced. Leah Williamson came off at half-time with some knee irritation. So Laia Kadina came on. And obviously, Frieda Marnham had to go off, so Alessia Russo replaced her, but he also brought on Ford, Catley and Cooney Cross. Chelsea, meanwhile, didn't make a single sub until the 77th minute, which was when Wrighton came on. And then Kat Macario came on in the 96th, and Aggie Beaver-Jones in the 119th when, you know, Chelsea were already losing. So I felt like fresh legs was a big determinant of, you know, how Arsenal were able to get the win. That being said, I think both sides had chances, and Hayes spoke in her post-match about basically about outcome bias, which I think is worth bearing in mind. You know, she sort of said she was asked about, not specifically about the subs, but about the schedule and the fact that, you know, Chelsea played 8 games in March, Arsenal played 5. But, you know, she said, look, Lauren James has this great chance at the end. It sort of comes off Zinsberger's hip and goes wide. And if that goes in, we're maybe having a totally different conversation. You're saying, Eidevall tried to mix it up too much, whereas Chelsea kept this sort of static, you know, consistent 11, and that enabled them to get the win. I just felt like watching the game, Chelsea had the options to freshen it up, especially given they played more games. You know, Frank Kirby didn't feature at all. We barely saw Aggie Beaver-Jones. Ashley Lawrence was on the bench as well. And I think ultimately that did just give Arsenal the edge as we went into that second period of extra time, which is obviously when they score.
Especially with that counter-attacking style of play that Arsenal were trying to use to score their goals with those fresh legs, that will have really helped. Do you think that it was a case of Arsenal doing anything to set themselves apart, or do you think it was just kind of they took that chance and Chelsea didn't take their chance just before?
Yeah, once we got to that period of the game, it felt very even. I think in the first half, Arsenal probably shaded things because they were able to really imposed themselves in a way that weren't at Stamford Bridge with Marnham, who I thought actually played really well. I feel she was one of, if not Arsenal's best performers on the day. And she did a really good job of just making sure Chelsea couldn't get any joy when building up play. But when you get into extra time, it is just about who is more clinical, who is more fresh also. And you saw Caitlin Ford, fresh legs on the left-hand side driving in. I think beforehand, she had a moment against Jess Carter where she just took too long to make a decision because she was so fresh, but she was just almost like she just didn't know what to do. But then when the moment came to actually pass the ball, she made the right choice. And Stina Blackstenius, again, she had missed a few chances beforehand because I don't think she realized how much time she actually had. But this time, she did what she needed to do. And that was her ninth goal in the Conti Cup. So I think adding that to her performance in the Conti Cup final last season, you could see she's someone who really kind of relishes the big moments for Arsenal since she's arrived almost 2.5 years ago now. So yeah, going into next season, I think it'll be really interesting to see how Edouard utilises his squad, because he has got a lot of options. And luckily, thankfully, whichever way people want to look at it, he utilised them quite well yesterday.
I find it interesting with Stina Blackstenius because, as you say, in the Conti Cup, top scorer, 9 goals. And then in the league, she's only had 4 starts and scored 5 goals. So when she's in the starting lineup, I never know what to think. I know that she's going to do great runs in behind, but I'm never certain that we're going to get that final product. Is that fair?
I think it mostly comes down to the dynamic of not just her, but what's happening around her. When, I guess, you're looking at the game yesterday, you had Beth Mead starting on the right-hand side with Lacasse on the left, where Lacasse is probably better, I'd say. But those two kept swapping, and you saw that Blackstenius was probably just, at that point in time, being used as a target with Marnham kind of around her. So there, she wasn't really the outlet, but then she became that when she could join up with Caitlin Ford in the final third. So I think the big thing with her is, I guess, having the right partnerships around her, and Russo coming on as a 10 really worked well with that, because she naturally drops in, but also had an eye for a pass. There was that really big chance before she scored where Russo clipped her over the top and she's just sliced the volley wide. But moments like that, I think, are signs that these players can work well together, but you just need to, I guess, find the right combinations.
And Jesse, just a final word on Chelsea's tactics. I mean, what more would you have liked to see from them, perhaps up front, to create more shots on target? Because they didn't have that many in the end, did they?
Yeah, I mean, Chelsea and Arsenal had fairly equal amounts of shots, but Arsenal definitely got more on target. I think we saw a bit of a poor day from Lauren James in front of goal in particular. I actually thought her defensive work rate was some of the best we've actually ever seen her do for Chelsea, and she did some amazing tracking back. But I think Chelsea's sort of tactical issues stemmed from Lauren James, and maybe is an interesting insight into the future of this Chelsea team and how it'll be moulded by the next manager, because obviously, James was selected to start on the left ahead of Guru Wrighton, but it kind of meant that the work that Guru Wrighton does in terms of tucking in and helping out that midfield just didn't really happen. And that gave Arsenal a natural overload, I think, in that area, which made it much easier for them to progress the ball up the pitch. You want to give LJ that freedom to go wherever she wants to get the ball, but, you know, that means you lose something else as a result. And I don't think there was anything wrong in Hayes giving that a go. I think it was understandable to want to try something different against this Arsenal team. And I thought, you know, Myra Ramirez did at points cause Arsenal a lot of problems. It made sense to use her up front. I wonder if playing Nuskan in that duo didn't really work. I thought she looked quite leggy. She's played a lot of football for Chelsea this month and this season in general. And I think as a result, maybe even just positioning her a bit more conservatively and encouraging LJ to come in and do the press from the left wing with Ramirez to do the 4-4-2 out possession thing that Chelsea like to do would have made more sense. I asked Hayes about this afterwards. She felt that it was sort of an individual issue, that Chelsea didn't take care of the ball enough, and that was where their issues were coming from, as opposed to sort of a tactical personnel issue. I kind of think I disagree, to be totally honest. I think generally when you see players making lots of individual mistakes, that normally reveals that something's gone wrong in how you've set them up, rather than just they've got rubbish all of a sudden. That being said, I do think Chelsea were nervous, and I think in particular a player who struggled was Hannah Hampton. She made some good saves. I think she probably could have done better on the goal, to be honest. But normally her gold star is her distribution, and that's why Chelsea have used her so much this season. But I think you could tell she was playing in her first cup final, and she loves playing these like little clipped passes back to Neve Charles. And the classic thing Chelsea do at the moment is they play the ball out to centre-backs, they wait for the centre-backs to get pressed, which was happening. Arsenal were using Carter as a trigger. Carter turns and plays it back to Hampton, who then chips over the press and gives Charles the space to run into. Problem was, every time Hannah Hampton went to do that, the ball was sailing out of play and, you know, Chelsea's build-up had to stop. So I think there was a mix of tactical issues in combination maybe with, you know, those little bit of nerves that come from having younger players. And Hayes has really prioritised bringing some of those younger players through towards the end of this season.
And you mentioned Mayra Ramirez there. Obviously, she did score a goal, didn't she? But it got ruled out because of a handball from Erin Cuthbert in the build-up. Seeing VAR used in this game, that was an interesting one. I feel like the VAR discussion is a can of worms that I'm not going to open right now. But it was interesting to see it being used in this game. Chelsea have 3 more titles that they can go at. They've got the Champions League against Barcelona. They've got the WSL and they've got the FA Cup. Art, you alluded to this before. Where do Arsenal go from this? Because that was their only chance at silverware and it's the only trophy that they've won for 2 years running now.
I think it's all about next year for Arsenal, if I'm being totally honest. Jonas Edervall, even last week, was speaking about how he's not going to wait until the end of the season to almost diagnose the issues of this one. And the big issue he's kind of landed on is inconsistency, which I'm pretty sure we've probably spoken about a bunch throughout the season in regards to them actually showing how competitive they can be against the country's top teams. But then when they're expected to win, that's where the difficulties have come. I think for now, especially with, I guess, the Hayes-Edervall era being closed for now, if they want to push on, now is the time to really do that. Or maybe I should say next season is the time to really do that.
Thank you so much for joining us, Art. We'll let you go now.
Thank you very much. See you later.
And I'll keep Jesse on to discuss the retirement of a legend.
You're listening to Full Time Europe with Sophie Penny.
Ex-England captain Steph Horton has announced she'll retire at the end of the season.
But balance, and she's got to touch it in, that's the breakthrough, and the captain gets it. Steph Horton, 1-0 England.
The 35-year-old captained England for 6 years until 2021, leading them to 3 major tournament semi-finals and getting 121 caps along the way. She started her club career back in 2002. She's played for Sunderland, Leeds United, Arsenal and now Man City. And what she won? Just 3 WSL titles, 5 FA Cups and 6 League Cups. Jesse, what are the standout Steph Horton moments that people need to start Googling right now?
I think really Horton should be predominantly remembered for being an incredible free kick taker. She's one of the very few players in football who, you know, as soon as she was standing over a free kick, obviously, you know, I'm a Chelsea fan, so in opposition predominantly, although of course for England, I enjoyed watching her do it. But you felt like she could really always score from those kind of situations. But obviously, you know, fantastic centre-back, very versatile player, you know, someone who started sort of up front and moved all the way back across the pitch. Maybe a standout moment potentially was the 2012 Olympics where she played left-back and scored 3 of Team GB's 5 goals in that tournament. So a great leader, a great personality, but also a fantastic defender and someone who for a number of years was seen as, you know, English football's best defender.
Every time England gets a free kick in a kind of Steph Horton spot now and she's not on the team, I go, where's Steph? She would be brilliant at taking that free kick. She's a guaranteed goal from that. And I think that's the interesting thing about Steph Horton, isn't it? It's kind of, she's been there for a long time building women's football as it is in England. But then she missed out on the Euro squad that won, the World Cup squad that got to the final in Australia and New Zealand. And there's a kind of odd juxtaposition there, isn't there, with Steph Horton, that she was key in building it, but didn't get to reap the rewards.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we've had such an amazing influx of fans into the game over the past couple of years. But it's fascinating to think about, you know, the players who I have felt as I've sort of grown up and watched women's football would be seen as, you know, the great legacy players, maybe how that will be impacted by the fact that there's a big chunk of fans who've kind of come later to the game. And I do think, you know, missing out on the Euros is something that I think was the right decision. I can totally understand why Wiegman did it. I think it made sense to pick a new captain, and I don't think Horton was good enough at that point in time to go.
She was coming back from injury, wasn't she?
She was coming back from injury, yeah. I can also understand why, you know, even on a personal level, maybe you didn't want the former captain, you know, as part of your building a new leadership team. And look, you can't fault how Wiegman did with the squad, so it's hard to look back and say it was the wrong decision. But I think it's one of those things where it's also okay to say, you know, that's a real shame. When you look at, I think Jill Scott's legacy is a really interesting one, because obviously Ellen White retires after that tournament as well, but she started every game. Jill Scott was there kind of as, you know, the old head in some ways in what was quite a young team, or had a lot of young players within it. And, you know, she's kind of been able to really, you know, invigorate a legacy and you know, build a fantastic kind of career off her personality, which is
Queen of the Jungle too.
Exactly, deserved. She's fantastic. But I think really shows you almost that sliding doors moment, that Horton was the face of the England team for years and years and years. But in terms of how women's football blew up around the Euros, how maybe that obscures what Horton did, because I think what has always really struck me is how important 2015, 2017 and 2019 were to 2022. And Wiegman's influence can't be denied in that win. But to reach three consecutive semi-finals before that, that was all pathway to get to the point that England did in 2022 and then the World Cup final in 2023. And 2015, 17 and 19, Steph Horton captained all of those tournament teams.
I think the phrase "helped build women's football," has been key in the growth of women's football, is sort of bandied around a bit. And I think it's something that can be given to a lot of players. But I think you're right to pick out kind of those three tournaments as key moments in what she built. But I wonder if we can dig a bit deeper into kind of what we mean by saying she helped grow the women's game in that way, and that she helped lead the England team. Kind of what was it that she actually did, if you see what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. It can be a bit sort of damning with faint praise, can't it? It kind of feels like, that's why it's good to lead on the free kicks. I'm like, she was a very good player as well.
Yeah.
I actually think the her influence on women's football is maybe less something to do with England, although obviously she was captain and, you know, she did everything that you'd expect from a captain to do with that team, including, you know, leading them through some really tricky points when you think about, you know, the accusations around Mark Sampson and being racist towards Eni Aluko, and then him eventually being sacked for having in the past had a relationship with a player. Equally, sort of the controversy that kind of surrounded Phil Neville's appointment, she was the steady hand. But I actually think it's Manchester City where it's really worth looking to the culture that she helped build there. You know, she was one of City's original pro standout signings. You know, she's their all-time leading appearance holder. She's their club captain. And I think to start a squad effectively from scratch, a squad who, you know, maybe at points, I think it's fair to say, in 2015, 2014, when they first started, you'd have thought they'd maybe won more WSL titles than they have. And maybe, you know, Steph will get that as her sort of final hurrah with that squad. But to start aside from scratch and consistently compete at the top of the WSL, which is what City have done, is no mean feat. And, you know, I wrote in my piece, it's something that their neighbours in Manchester know all too well about how, you know, easily up and down things can go in a league where people are, you know, investing a lot and money counts for a lot in football. The culture you build off the pitch matters a lot too. And I think you only have to look at the youth development that City have done and what it means and the tributes that were paid to Steph around that from players who've spent time at the club. Georgia Stanway, Kira Walsh. You're also talking about players like Ella Toon, who were there, you know, and now coming through now players like Jess Park, like Kiara Keating. These are all players who grew up under Steph's leadership. And I think that almost, you know, is her lasting legacy, sort of the culture and the development that she has been able to do and work within at Manchester City.
We obviously can't talk about Steph without talking about what she's gone through off the pitch as well, with her husband being diagnosed with motor neuron disease. And they've kind of set up this Derby Rimmer Foundation, who I know a lot of the women's football journalists have fundraised for, just to try and find a cure for motor neuron disease, which affects a lot more people than you would have thought. I mean, it's just testament to her character, isn't it, really, to be able to compartmentalize that part of your life and still be able to perform on a football pitch. I just can't imagine what she's going through at home and being able to kind of leave that at home.
Yeah, I think it's also testament to her love for football and her love for being part of the game. I definitely think there's, you know, lots of people who have sort of said, you know, myself included, it'd have been perfectly understandable for her to retire, you know, quite a while ago, even to retire when she wasn't selected for the Euros, given, you know, obviously all the stuff that she has off the field, you know, both in terms of supporting her husband and the charity work that's come from it as a result. But, you know, I think also that's, yeah, testament to her mentality in that she wanted to give it as good as it got until she felt like she didn't want to anymore. And, you know, I think it's sad on one hand that maybe the injury she's had over the past couple of years has meant that she hasn't, you know, been in the England squad, hasn't really played that much for Manchester City either. But I also think it's testament to her as a person that despite all of that, she was like, well, I'm not done yet. And I want to give it a good go until I'm ready to call time on my career. And I think, you know, that's why it's so important to be able to pay tribute to her, because her career is so much more than the last 2 years, which realistically, you know, there's no way of sugarcoating it, has been about being either in the rehab room or a bench player. But also that's why it's important to talk about that off-field impact, because, you know, just because a player sitting on the bench every week doesn't mean they're not doing loads for the squad. And, you know, it's fitting, I think, that Manchester City are having the best season that they've had in a number of years.
Well, yeah, that's right. And she might get a chance at a last hurrah that Man City are leading the WSL title race. Obviously, Chelsea have a game in hand, so she may have more silverware to come. And speaking of Manchester City, I also want to wish Ellie Roebuck all the best in her recovery. And she announced on social media this week that she'd suffered a stroke, and thankfully she had no lasting damage to her brain or her vision. But we at The Athletic want to wish her all the best. Jesse, thank you so much for joining me on today's show.
Thank you for having me.
You'll have heard that Willie Kirk was sacked as Leicester City manager over an alleged relationship with a player. You can listen to our podcast recorded earlier this month where we discuss player-coach relationships, and you'll find all the updates on The Athletic. It's just $1.99 a month for 12 months. Sign up at theathletic.com/WSL. As always, send in your questions via email to fte@theathletic.com or at @theathleticfc on socials. Please take a moment to rate, review, and hit follow wherever you get your podcasts. Bye for now.
You've been listening to Full Time Europe, part of The Athletic Football Podcast Network. The producer was Sophie Penny, and the executive producer was Abby Patterson. To discover and listen to other great Athletic podcasts just like this one, including our brand new daily football briefing, search for The Athletic on Apple, Spotify, and everywhere else you get your audio on demand.
The Athletic.